It is 7:09 in the Twin Cities. Just a football update, folks, if you're kind of following but not following quite closely enough. The playoff games today, the Philadelphia Eagles win. And the reason that's important, Jonathan Lowe explained during the break, is that if the Vikings do win, of course, when the Vikings win tomorrow, when they beat the Saints, what will happen, Jonathan?
They'll have to go to Philadelphia. Philadelphia, having won the top overall seed, has the they will host. They had the right to host through up to the Super Bowl. So right. The Vikings will not have the fairy tale run where they can host every game up to and through the Super Bowl. They have to go to Philadelphia if they win tomorrow.
When they win tomorrow.
Potato, potato.
Okay. That's more than potato, potato. All right, folks. My next guest is Ellen Johnson. She's a Regents Hospital sexual assault nurse examiner. And they have done a lot of things over there to create new systems to help not only those people who are victims, but also their families as well. I thought this was really an important and interesting story. Ellen Johnson is joining us now. Nurse Johnson, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, tell me, this effort of providing a system, and you actually, there's a name for it, a sexual assault nurse examiner, and there's a program, the SANE program, has been going back a number of years. Tell us how it originated and how it's changed over the years.
Well, the sexual assault nurse examiner role is probably 40 years old.
Wow.
So, yeah. Regents Hospital has had their program since 2002, and through those years, it's become more and more entrenched, viable, very worthwhile to the patients that come to our emergency room and now to our greater community, too. One of the best services we can provide our patients is to partner with advocacy. And we have an advocate with us whenever we do an exam for each and every patient. And that is invaluable to our patients.
In terms of what kinds of services do you provide? And is this kind of program available everywhere or just, you know, a few hospitals?
Actually, every hospital in the Twin Cities is served by a SANE program.
Oh, that's great.
Not every hospital in Minnesota nor the country is served by a SANE program. But the metro area is very fortunate in that it's well covered.
Okay. Have there been changes in procedures over the years?
There has. And the biggest one, I would say, is that the time frame for doing medical forensic exams and the capability to collect evidence for the crime lab has extended. And we are currently at 10 days.
Wow.
So that's a huge benefit to patients.
Wow. Okay. So in other words, if there is an assault, and I can only think that for many people, obviously this is just a horrific trauma, but I would think that there are many people who are just mentally, emotionally, even physically unable to come in.
And that's one of the reasons the 10-day time limit is so beneficial, because it is really hard to wrap your head around what you need to do to take care of yourself. And so that extended time frame is very helpful. And if they can come and get an interaction, an exam by a SANE with help and support from an advocate, that leads to much better long-term health outcomes, because they've addressed the issue rather than just, you know, pulled the covers over their head and tried to ignore it. It doesn't go away.
I would have to imagine, though, evidence collected at day 10 possibly could have been compromised. Is there a falling off, and to what degree, if you wait that long?
Absolutely. Absolutely. From an evidence perspective, the sooner the better. And I would love if every patient who's been sexually assaulted could come right away. Realistically, I know that doesn't happen. And ultimately, we may not get evidence when we make our attempt at collection. but we always provide health care, and that has long-term health benefits.
Right. Well, it's probably possible that even somebody coming in the next day, that evidence could not be, you know, I guess it just depends on a case-by-case basis.
Right. There's many reasons. There may be no physical evidence that perhaps a condom was worn. Perhaps there was contact that didn't result in an evidence transfer. Perhaps there was some bathing and maybe only the exterior was impacted. Each and every scenario is different.
In terms of you know, the collections, you know, on day 10, how does it work? Does somebody, because I would imagine coming in to see a nurse would be, I mean, these are medical professionals who obviously have the training in to interact with people who have just been through a traumatic experience. I would think that for some people, for some victims, I would think that there might be a greater comfort in talking to a nurse as opposed to a law enforcement officer.
Absolutely, and that's a benefit for our patients, but it's also a benefit for the system. Because we ask our patients a lot of very personal questions, and just the fact that I'm a nurse, I have more credibility and ability to ask those questions and to be able to get those answers. Through no fault of, you know, any law enforcement officer, I'm a nurse. People look at me different than they would look at an officer.
Right. Well, I think people know that you know, nurses are there for your health.
Absolutely.
And I think we've all grown up interacting with nurses to a certain extent and medical professionals. And so I think the comfort level is and the realization that you're there as a healer, somebody to help heal, would provide that comfort level, especially for a lot of victims. So I can see that completely. But do you work with the officer, or is it just, do they see you first, or how does it work?
Well, a patient can access our services in many different ways. They can report to law enforcement first, or they can come to the hospital first. They don't have to report to law enforcement to get an exam by us. And it's really quite a fallacy when people think that we work with law enforcement. We partner to serve the victim survivor, but we're not an extension of law enforcement.
Of course.
Yeah.
Are there occasions when people come to you and they say that they're not ready to report, but they just want to get medical treatment?
Yes, and I applaud that, because the treatment is beneficial now. And if they'll allow us to collect some cotton swabs, which potentially may have evidence, that gives them some time to think about it. And they don't have to make a decision about whether to report. But then they can get their health needs
I see what you're saying.
Addressed right away.
Yeah, because I would imagine that, I don't know what the statute of limitations is, but it's got to be at least a few years. So they
oh, certainly.
So then you've got the evidence collected, you've got the record of them making the report, even if they were not ready. And have prosecutors and law enforcement been receptive to those who have, and completely understandably, chosen to wait? Because oftentimes, as awful as that is, these are people who are known to these individuals.
It's not that unusual to have a report that is later rather than sooner.
Right.
It certainly makes their life easier, the legal system, if a report is made sooner. But they are still going to investigate. We are going to keep that kit for at least 3 months. I can't keep it for 5 years if the patient doesn't make a police report, because I don't have the refrigerator space for the hundreds of kits to be stocked. And that's a question that Minnesota and across the country we're grappling with. What do we do with these kits for cases that are not reported?
Wow.
It's much easier to figure out if it is reported.
Wow. That's something to think about as well, because clearly you have the potential too in these kits. If somebody is that aggressive to do it once, they're certainly capable of doing it again.
And that is often the case.
Yes. let me ask you, so how does it work? Do people just literally walk into the ER and say, I've been assaulted, and then they are immediately assigned to somebody like you, or like a sane nurse, a trained nurse?
If they can say the words, if they can say that they need to be seen for sexual assault, they need to be seen for rape, then they are quickly brought to a room. This is treated as a true emergency. This patient is not going to spend hours in the lobby. They're going to spend minutes and not any longer.
And you're saying that is good to know. So even in, because I had the misfortune of having to go to the emergency room, not for something like this, but just a physical injury to my husband, and I was stunned on Thursday in the middle of the afternoon how busy the emergency room was. And I was told that emergency rooms all over the Twin Cities at this very moment are unbelievably overtaxed, largely because of the flu. And
absolutely.
But they would go to straight to the front of the line.
Yes.
That's great. That's great. Yes. I know that you're also working on helping families and loved ones of assault victims try and deal with this, because that's got to be difficult as well.
Yes. One of the ways that we do that is connect them with advocacy. They have information that is directly helpful to families. We also have information that we can give to families. It's difficult to know what to say to your loved one who has been assaulted because you're so afraid of saying the wrong thing, when mostly people just need you to listen and to be supportive and to be there.
And they're hurting, too, because they're hurting for their loved one.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so that's so difficult as well. So in terms of what would you like people to know about the resources that are out there? I guess it sounds like the Twin Cities proper is well-staffed. Doesn't sound like you've got that covered to the extent that you'd like in the larger outlying areas of the state.
That's right. And a lot of it is because of the less densely populated areas. It's hard to maintain training and expertise in nurses that may not see enough patients to maintain that expertise. One of the things that we're doing at Regions is we have training that we provide, actually hands-on training with real people, and we have nurses from all over the country come to do practice exams and to learn how to do a sexual assault exam on a real patient, real person, I should say.
Right, right. Okay, well, this is just something that people should know and be aware of. I know you've been doing it for a long time, and it's fascinating to hear the fact that it can now go 10 days. Although your message is you'd like to see people as soon as possible. But
right. Right.
That's an option as well. Well, Ellen Johnson with Regents Hospital, registered nurse and a sexual assault nurse examiner. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you.
All right. Absolutely. Fascinating stuff here. All right, folks. We are going to take a break. Much more. We're going to talk about Parkinson's. What a terrible disease that is, and some of the advances in terms of research and diagnosis and help. Also give you some weather. And then my friend Dave Schultz. Talk to him when we come back in the 8 o'clock hour. But let's take a quick break now. Much more ahead. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Ooh, we're down to 1 degree, folks. I've got my coat on in the studio. It's like, I don't know. It just makes me cold just looking at that 1 degree is just flashing at me on the monitor here. Esme Murphy with you, along with Jonathan Lowe. We were talking about the Vikings playoff tickets. His team, poor Jonathan from KC, still nursing the wound, talking about how depressed he was after the Titans dished it out. I mean, they were ahead, too. And it was hard. You know, I remember 98. I remember that field goal going, no.
Here's the thing I was talking to Esme about during the break. I understand the pain of Vikings fans. I understand. They haven't been to a Super Bowl in going on 40 years now. I believe it has been 40. There was heartbreak in the NFC Championship game in 2009. There was heartbreak in 1998. There was just a smash job in, what was it, 2000, I believe, when they went to New York. I understand the pain. But the pain that I go through as a fan of the Kansas City Chiefs and the Kansas City Royals and the Missouri Tigers, your pain pales in comparison to my pain.
I've seen those pain index stories. Aren't we like number one in pain when it comes to sports?
Here's
I think we're number one, Jonathan.
Here's where I differ with you. So, yes, the Vikings have had some painful losses. At least in the last 25 years, they've won a playoff game at home. That's what the Kansas City Chiefs have not
when?
Done. They have not won a playoff
game. But
when
did the Vikings went home? Was it 2000?
They won one in 2009. I thought against Dallas when Dallas came up here.
Okay.
They've won a few. They've won a few. To get to the NFC Championship game in 2000, they had to win one. To get to it in 99, they had to win one.
They've come so close.
They've come so close.
Many
yes,
times.
They've come so close. But again, at least every now and again, they can give the home fans some kind of little treat by winning a playoff game at home.
What has been an amazing story. Now, I was looking, we were talking earlier about the price of Super Bowl tickets, which are, I literally saw an article, folks, and Jonathan says that it would be accurate to say that one ticket, $4,000 for the Super Bowl. I just
absolutely.
Like, and that's not even a great seat.
I don't think $4,000 will go for the nosebleeds necessarily. I say four figures will go for the nosebleeds. Maybe high threes, maybe over $600, $700.
Wow.
But when you're getting into those areas, you know, the middle up, not the middle of the field, but the midway point going up in the stands, I could definitely see $4,000 to $5,000. They're selling a bunch of these corporate seats for well into the five figures.
Wow. Well, I'm just glancing here because my husband's recovering from a bad leg accident, so he's going to be in the hospital. So I think we can probably watch it in the hospital room. But I'm looking at that there are tickets, but it's $200 plus for nosebleeds, $300 plus for like section 134, row 20, which is, I guess, a pretty good seat. So,
but for tomorrow,
that's not for the Super Bowl.
That's not for the Super Bowl. Absolutely.
Yeah, on Ticketmaster, and which is a reputable thing. And I think you also be really careful on the secondary market because
we've had stories on our air.
It happens all the time. You know, the people do get burned, and even one of these, I guess, these laser printers are so good now they can actually duplicate even what appear to be some of these 3D techniques
the holograms.
And anyway, so just if you're buying tickets on the secondary market, be careful. It's going to be really cold. It'll be a long, chilly walk back from the stadium after you're out a few $100s. But anyway, but there are Ticketmaster, obviously reputable. Looks like there's still a bunch of tickets if you got a little buck here. All right, folks, we are going to take a break and give you some weather if you really want to hear it. It's just not very – it's awfully cold. And then we're going to talk with a doctor about Parkinson's disease and what kinds of things we can look forward to in terms of treatments. Such a devastating, devastating ailment and so many people afflicted. So we'll visit with Dr. Eleanor Orrick from – Abbott Northwestern Hospital. But first, we want to take a break, and we do want to give you this just delightful weather forecast. It is 7:37 in the Twin Cities. 1 degree, folks, 1 degree. Well, amongst the diseases that I think are so cruel is Parkinson's, which slowly sees people degenerate in terms of their ability to use their muscles, to use parts of their bodies. And I thought it'd be interesting to just kind of visit with an expert about the kinds of advances that are being made. Also, you know, there are so many prominent people that have Parkinson's disease. One of the latest to announce that he has been battling Parkinson's is 76-year-old Reverend Jesse Jackson. Joining me right now is Dr. Eleanor Orrick from Allina Hospitals, Abbott Northwestern Hospital, and she's with the Noran Neurological Clinic. And Dr. Orrick, am I saying your name correctly?
It's Orehek.
Orehek. Okay. Well, my apologies.
Yeah. No, that's all right.
But anyway, Dr. Orehek, thank you so much for coming on. You know, I think that we do see people with Parkinson's. You certainly hear about it. And it just seems like such a devastating ailment to deal with. I guess what I'd like to ask, if you can just start, what is Parkinson's exactly? And what does it do? What exactly does it do to people?
So Parkinson's is complex, so trying to explain it can be tricky, but it is what we call a neurodegenerative disease and the second most common neurodegenerative disease, and that means that it's a disease that affects the nerve cells in the brain and causes progressive loss of cells, and in Parkinson's that affects the ability for the brain to control how you move and causes things like tremor and slowness, stiffness, and a variety of other symptoms as well.
And is the path of the disease the same in everybody, or does it develop and progress at different rates?
It varies for everybody, so that makes it a challenge. I mean, it's sometimes even a challenge just to diagnose it, and then even if you get more of a clear diagnosis, trying to tell people, you know, what does the future look like? A lot of questions is like, well, what should I expect? And it is a really hard question sometimes to answer because everybody has different symptoms that they're struggling with, and then treatment varies for everybody and how you respond to treatment, and life doesn't stop when you get diagnosed with Parkinson's, so then you're trying to live your life, and you have Parkinson's thrown into the mix, so it just gives everybody different challenges and struggles that they're trying right. to deal with. So
this is the disease that I think, you know, nobody's done more for it than Michael J. Fox in terms of publicizing it. He was so young, yeah. though, when he
right.
got it.
Yeah.
Is there an average age for onset?
Yeah, he was on the very young side. So the average age is in your 60s, kind of mid-60s. There are people, though, that get it in their 20s and 30s, so that's important to remember. But for the most part, it's older age. Is a big risk factor.
Can you sort of kind of give the list of what, and you mentioned that it's often frequently misdiagnosed. What are some of the common early symptoms, and why would it be misdiagnosed? Because it, you know, it's a pretty well-known ailment.
It is well known, and if people have tremor, that's obviously more visible, and it's a particular kind of tremor. So not all tremors are Parkinson's, which is a misconception, but you don't have to have tremor to have Parkinson's. So that also, if you don't have any tremor, and it's more the slowness and stiffness that develops slowly over time, people think it's aging or other things, or they have pain in a shoulder, and so they go around to different people trying to figure out what's causing the pain when it actually it's Parkinson's underlying it. And so
is it often misdiagnosed though?
Yes. I mean, it is. I don't know the percentage of it, but until you find the right neurologist or specialist to look for the right things, that can go misdiagnosed or undiagnosed for a long time.
And how about medications? I mean, how effective are they, and are there potential breakthroughs around the corner, or is it something that's a long way off?
Yeah, no, I think there are some breakthroughs that are around the corner. There are a lot of treatments that we have right now to help manage people's symptoms so people can have a really good quality of life for a long time living with Parkinson's. And what we're missing is medications and treatment options that actually stop the disease or slow the disease from progressing. So exercise, which I tell all my patients to do as regularly as possible, is really the best thing that we have that may potentially slow the disease. So we're waiting on some breakthroughs as far as other medications or treatments to offer people.
We're chatting with Dr. Eleanor Orehek. She's from the Neurological at Northwestern. In terms of what people can do, what kind of lives they can lead, you know, I was in a grocery store recently, actually downtown, and well, I mentioned it was Lund's, and I was distracted by somebody moving in a very sort of jerky way. I didn't realize they had a uniform on, and I feel mortified by it, but I said to one of the managers, I said, there's somebody kind of behaving erratically, which is not that unusual in downtown Minneapolis. and they looked at me and said, well, that's our employee with Parkinson's, and I felt just terrible about it. But I thought, well, good for them for hiring people. But it must be very difficult when you have those kinds of tremors to hold on to workplace situations.
Yeah, it can be. And so that's why when it affects people before retirement age or before they're ready to stop working, it can be even more challenging. Or if you're trying to raise children, you know, there's a lot of things that make it more challenging to live with. The best thing you can do is try to get the medications managed right and exercise. And if you can do that, and there's deep brain stimulation and other treatment options that can help manage some of the tremors. And the jerky movements may have been dyskinesias, and so that's a medication side effect. So if you can get the dose of the medication adjusted correctly, it can help lessen those sometimes. So
and what is
there
the,
are ways to help.
Yeah. And what is the final, I mean, how far does it go? I mean,
well, the end stages, I mean, are also variable. It doesn't itself lead to death, but it can increase the risk of having complications like trouble swallowing that leads to pneumonia or fall risk, and then you end up fracturing a hip or something. So those are the things we work to look for and prevent if possible.
And to what degree is it hereditary?
So far, to a small degree, and we're learning more and more about the genetics of the disease the more we test people with it. But right now, it's only about 10% of cases that seem to have a genetic correlation to it.
Really? So you can't tell? I mean, is there a gene for it? Like if you have it in your family, can you go get tested and they'll say, oh, you've got such and such a gene like you can for breast cancer?
Yes, you could. I mean, so there are certain more common ones related to it that you can get tested for. I would caution not to do it unless you've talked to a genetic counselor just so you fully understand what that means if you do have the mutation, because not everybody goes on to get it even if you do have it. But that is something that's available.
And in terms of the life expectancy, once somebody's been diagnosed, is there a set life expectancy, or is it just something that people live with for decades?
Right, yeah. People can live with it for 20, 30 years. So it's, I mean, everybody is different, and it's certainly in its like 15, 20 years or more, you're going to have a lot more trouble with it. And depending on what sorts of end stage symptoms you have, that makes it more or less challenging to live with it in later stages. But
okay.
Certainly is possible.
And are there, is it particularly, certainly, Reverend Jackson, is, you know, there are some of these diseases that are more prevalent in certain, you know, ethnic groups. Is this, does it sort of cut across every ethnic group, or in every country, or is it more prevalent here in the U.S.?
It does cut across all ethnic groups. I think the data on some of the different populations is lacking, so it's hard to know for sure, but it certainly affects everybody.
All right. What would you like, and again, the symptoms, those initial symptoms, which you'd say are often misdiagnosed, what are some of those that people should be aware of?
Well, certainly tremor. If you have any tremors, it's always good to get that checked out, at least ask your regular doctor and see if it's worth getting referred to a neurologist or a Parkinson's specialist. If you start noticing there's changes in your walking or speech or handwriting, those are things that like the smaller writing can be signs of it. I would say those things would be worthy of, if you notice balance problems, certainly worthy of getting checked out.
Okay. Well, interesting stuff. And obviously it's something that a lot of people, wonderful people, do have to live with. Dr. Eleanor Orehek, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Parkinson's.
Yeah, of course. You're welcome.
Absolutely. All right, folks, much ahead on News Radio 830 WCCO. We're going to take a quick break. We'll have some thoughts coming up. And then, of course, my friend David Schultz coming up at the 8 o'clock hour. So keep it here, News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
How are you? 751, 1 degree. In the break, I started off the show explaining that my husband wiped out snow blowing the driveway on Thursday night. He's been hospitalized with a pretty serious leg injury ever since. Obviously, it's serious because these days you have a baby and they kick you out 12 hours later. But we're going to make it. We're luckier than a lot of people out there. But I was literally just arranging for a plow service. I literally was on my way back from the hospital one of these nights and stopped. There was a plow guy at the neighbor's house, and I was like, please, can I hire you? So the guy was nice enough to say yes, and I got to do the contract and everything like that. But I don't know if anybody out there has any tips for avoiding wiping out on the ice. I mean, I suppose it's just part of the threat of sort of the environment we live in, but do you have any suggestions? Obviously the salt and all of that, but now I'm ultra paranoid. I'm sure he's going to be ultra paranoid. His snow blowing days are done. I want to make sure of that. But I don't know if there's any way to really prevent. I know that there are those ice clamps or these steel spikes you can put on your boots and to keep you from sliding. I suppose that would work. If you have something really good or foolproof, 651-989-9226. 1-866-989-9226. Let me see if I can get on my vibes here. The system. I'd love to hear any suggestions. If anybody has anything that really is effective, obviously salting the driveway helps before. And I don't know. I just wanted to throw it out there. And I guess there's not a lot you can do. We also have kind of a longer driveway that's on a hill. That doesn't help. But it is something that even younger people, I mean, my husband's certainly not younger. He's in his 50s. But a lot of it can happen to anybody, obviously. And so just wondering if anybody has any solutions or tips or suggestions, especially when it gets this cold, when some of the salt and stuff doesn't work. Now, maybe I should put the salt out. I don't know what to do. Anyway, maybe I should put the salt out tonight ahead of the snow. Is that the better way to go? I have hired a snow plow thing, but maybe when I get home tonight, I did buy some salt. Should I go and put the salt on the driveway tonight? It's not a huge driveway. It is a longer driveway. It's about 40 feet, which is longer, and it is a hill. I mean, it's a hill. Anyway, I would love to hear your suggestions because husband's not going to be doing it. It's all me. Well, actually, my son, who's actually coming back from Moorhead tonight from a hockey game, he's not going to be able to help me. He's 18. People are calling to help me. Okay, all right, great. I need the help. Let's go to my phone lines here because the texters weren't delivering. And all right, let's go to Betty in St. Louis Park. Betty, any suggestions for me?
Yes, Ashley, and I really listen to you every time you're on. And
oh, you're so sweet. TV, thank you.
You do a fabulous job. Frank Vassalera was talking about some kind of new moccasin that he just got. He was telling Jordana and Paul about them that have a special something in the sole to walk on ice. It's a moccasin that he's been wearing for years, but he was just talking about it a couple of days
ago. Well, I know where to find Frank Vassalero, so I will definitely ask him, Betty.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I see him all the time. Lucy in Hopkins. Hey there. I love that there are all these women calling. Thank you.
Yeah.
Lucy, what is your suggestion?
Well, I have really severe osteoporosis, and what has liberated me in the wintertime is a product called Stabilizers. You can find them online. Can I mention a store where they're available?
Of course.
Yeah. The last time I needed them, they were available online through REI. And what they are is a neoprene rubber platform that's the shape of the sole of your boot that has about a couple dozen carbide steel teeth screwed into the bottom of it and Velcro straps that go over your toe and around your ankle.
Okay.
They don't budge. They're a little cumbersome to put on and off, but that you can walk on sheer ice as long as you kind of bite down and plant your foot. They're meant for hiking on glaciers.
Wow, okay. Great idea, Lucy. He's got I'm a small person. My husband is a tall person. He's 6'5", and his foot is like a 14 or 15. I did get him once, and he was like kind of poo-pooing them. But good idea. Thank you so much. Lisa in Prior Lake, thank you so much for calling in. What's your suggestion?
So my my son is a truck driver, and he showed me something he buys at Costco, and it's just one of those things that you put over your shoe, and he goes, these have saved my life so many times. And they were, I think they were like $15.
And did they have, because the last caller had talked about the metal spikes. What do these have on them?
It had like little metal. They weren't quite spiky, but it was like rubber and then metal sticking out of it on the bottom.
Okay, at Costco. Okay, great. Thank you so much, Lisa. And Mary in Menominee, super quick, what is your suggestion?
Hi, my son just bought me a pair of ice bugs. They are amazing.
Ice bug.
They're very pricey, but they have titanium studs in them, and they are amazing.
Okay, great. I mean, what a wonderful son, Mary. Terrific. Well, listen, folks, thanks so much. I guess I need to invest in those. We did have a little problem because his feet are so big, but he's done. He's done snow blowing. I ain't going to happen anymore. I'm not going to have my son do it either. I can't handle it. So thank you so much, everybody. All right, folks, coming up, my friend, Professor David Schultz, haven't talked to him on the radio in this new year. That's coming up.